Welcome everybody. My name is David Mitra and I'm going to be giving the talk this afternoon. It is, strictly speaking, just afternoon. So, first of all, I'd just like to say I'm gratified to see so many of you here this afternoon, almost said this morning. And I'm going to be talking to you apparently about fear. I've given a number of talks recently, well, two or three anyway, on this particular theme. Some of you will have heard them. So I hope that I don't repeat what I've said on those occasions, but you may find that I'm talking around similar areas. Fear is a universal human emotion, and it's one which most people find very, very difficult to deal with. Of all the possible emotions we can feel, perhaps fear is the one we'd most prefer not to have. The extent to which we are affected by fear in our daily lives probably escapes us. And that's because usually we're so distracted by other things. Yes, please do come in. We're distracted by all sorts of things from our immediate experience. Please take some mats or cushions from the back. You're going to be okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So that we don't really know what's driving us, what's underlying our actions, what's determining our behaviour. Okay. But very often, I think when people settle down, when they have a moment or two to be quiet, you might just become aware that there's some sort of background anxiety. I remember when I was young, when I was a teenager, my parents were very concerned about me because I wanted to become an actor. And they said, but look, there's no security in that. And I wasn't sure what security was anyway. I wasn't even sure I wanted it. It sounded rather confining to me. But they insisted, you must have security. And I didn't, as I say, I didn't know what that meant. But as time passed, they insisted more and more, what about your security? And I didn't know what they were talking about. But it seems that most people do have an idea that we have to get security, that you must have security in life, whatever that means. I think probably for most of us it means financial security. It means a settled lifestyle, a place where you know you can always stay, your own home, and so forth. But when I was a young boy, certainly when I was a teenager, I couldn't understand why people wanted this. But looking back at it now, it seemed that what was driving my parents and what drives this view, in fact, I'd even say this myth of security, is, of course, the opposite, a sense of insecurity. And insecurity is simply a manifestation of anxiety, which is a very mild manifestation of fear. So probably most people are driven, perhaps without knowing it, by fear, by anxiety at least. You want a place that you feel that you can rely upon. You want a life which is secure. And so you do everything you can in life to try to bring about those conditions which will give you that security. But actually nothing can. Because the world is very unpredictable and it's very insecure and it's subject to change. So what you can hope for, the best you can hope for really is that whatever you invest in, whether it's a pension scheme, a house, family, whatever it is that you, wherever it is you place your interests, the best you can hope for is that it gives you a sense of security. But that sense of security, for the most part, will be a false sense of security because life cannot be predicted. The only certain thing in life is that one day all of us are going to die. The rest is just up for grabs. That's the only thing we know for certain. So whether you realize it or not, whether you know it or not, to some extent your life will be governed by fear. This is, of course, why we buy such things as insurance policies against all sorts of things. What we're trying to do is make the insecure world a secure place, or at least give ourselves a sense that it's secure, when as actually it's not. I suppose I was particularly aware of this when I was younger because I lived through the years of the Cold War. I lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis. And believe me, there didn't seem to be very much secure about the world at that time. Something else that struck me, this was many, many years later, but my father had spent most of his life investing in a pension, something which I never did and I never would do. When the time for retirement came, he got much less money than he'd bargained for, and 4 years after he retired, he died anyway. And I couldn't help feeling, what a waste of time, what a waste of life. That was certainly not for me. But anyway, whatever way we find fear manifests in our own lives, it's something we have to learn to deal with, which I suppose is the real theme of this morning's talk. How do we deal with the fear that confronts us? Because from time to time it will. People have all sorts of different fears. Perhaps the most common, the deepest, the one that affects all of us really, ultimately, usually, is fear of death. And I believe that psychologists even say that ultimately all fear can be reducible to fear of death. And that sort of makes sense from a Buddhist point of view too, but I'll come on to that perhaps a little bit later. Yes, we may fear rejection, we may fear loss. Usually people do fear loss. They fear loss of their possessions, they fear the loss of their loved ones, they may fear the loss of their work or even loss of status, all sorts of things. Fear of ridicule is something else which is quite common. So we'll behave in a way which staves off these kind of experiences. So every time we react to fear, whatever way our fear manifests, we are actually confining ourselves. We're limiting ourselves. We're restricting our human potential, if you like. There's nothing which will prevent you from doing something so much as fear. So if you really want to lead a full life, a full human life, let alone a Buddhist life or a spiritual life, you must do something about fear. Otherwise, you'll be cramped. You'll be like you're living in a tiny box. And that's what I didn't want when I was a young man. And I reacted very strongly to this idea of the pursuit of security. And there was no security in the profession I chose. There was even less when I gave it up. But it's never limited what I can do as a human being. So how do we go about dealing with fear? Well, the Buddhist tradition is very good on this, actually, because it recognizes the universal experience of fear. Even the Buddha himself talks about what he did in order to overcome fear. Before the Buddha became enlightened, that is to say, realized his fullest human potential, or if you like, saw through to the ultimate reality of things, he was affected by fear, especially in the period immediately leading up to his enlightenment. And he gives a description of his own experience. He says, well, he was aware that fear was had a hold in his own mind somewhere, and he was determined to overcome it. He wanted to overcome it. So he thought, well, okay, let me put myself into the situation or the situations which give rise or which are most likely to give rise to that fear. So what he did, he would go out into the jungle late at night, completely dark, or go into a cave somewhere which was where there's no light, where you know he was completely alone, and he'd just sit and he'd wait, or he'd stand and he'd wait, or he'd walk up and down and wait. And then when the fear arose, what he decided to do is, if he was lying down and the fear arose, he continued to lie down. If he was sitting down, he continued to sit down. If he's walking to and fro, he continued to walk to and fro. If he was just standing, he continued to stand until the fear had passed. And in that way, he was gradually able to overcome his fear. Because what he found was that if he didn't react to it, then it would just pass quite naturally. It arose and then it left him. And it's very interesting that the fact that he didn't stop doing whatever he was doing. So that, for example, if he was lying down, he continued to lie down. He didn't sit up, he didn't get up and walk around. He just continued to lie down. So what that says to me is that He didn't allow the fear to determine his behavior, his action. He just let the fear be. He didn't try and push it away. He just experienced it fully. It was obviously very strong. He described it in terms of panic, fear, and dread. I mean, they're very strong manifestations of fear. So he let them arose and then let them subside. And in that way, he gradually overcame them. So throughout Buddhist history, practicing Buddhists have followed his example. They've put themselves in situations where they know fear will arise. I mean, sometimes they've done some pretty extreme things. Even so late as the turn of the 20th century, there were monks in Thailand who were deliberately going into the jungle late at night, walking down well-known tiger tracks, knowing full well that if they went so far, they would encounter tigers, and they certainly did. Most of them, though not all, lived to tell the tale. And the reason they did that was, well, obviously because they knew that it would induce fear. And they knew that fear was something that ultimately they had to overcome, and they wanted to overcome it. And so that's what they did. And there's some quite hair-raising tales, even some quite amusing tales about that, which you can read about in a book called Forest Recollections, if you're interested in this. It's on sale in the bookshop, but perhaps it's a specialist interest. Indian yogis in the medieval period in India, the great tantric yogis, so-called, they did something else, although some of these Thai Buddhists did the same recently. But they go to the cremation ground. They go to the cremation ground at night, on a moonless night, and they'd sit and meditate. Their preference was to sit on an unconsumed corpse and just wait and see what happens. So obviously you have to have strong nerves for this practice. We don't recommend it to beginners. I don't think I could do it. Of course, fear would inevitably arise in their minds. And then they had the opportunity to face it, to deal with it. So in principle, you understand what to do. But we're not recommending that you do any such extreme things as this. But in principle, what you have to learn to do, if you want to overcome your fear, and I would say, therefore, lead a fuller life, is to learn to face it without going into extreme situations. But let's say, if you find yourself feeling a little bit anxious, don't turn on the television to distract yourself from it. Or don't pick up a book to read about it. Just let it be. Just experience it. Let it be. If you don't react to it, in time, it will pass. That can't be guaranteed in all circumstances. It may persist for a long time, and it may be, if you're of a certain temperament or disposition, that might not be the best way forwards for you. But I think for most people, just sit and let it be. In our own movement, London Buddhist Centre is part of the Tri Ratna Buddhist community, which is quite a worldwide Buddhist movement now. And in our own movement, especially those of us who are ordained, those of us who wear these things, go off regularly into a solitary retreat. And because in solitude, of course, you're alone. You're completely alone. You don't see anybody. And you might be there for a month or much longer. I was there for 9 months on one of my recent retreats. So to be alone like that is another experience which can induce fear, and which, in a sense, is an opportunity, therefore, to face it and go beyond it. But again, that for most people, that's perhaps at this stage a little bit too much to consider. But just try and think, well, what am I afraid of? What things give rise to fear in me? What situations? Or if you find yourself suddenly afraid because of something that's happened, well, just stay with the fear. Let it be. Just let it pass. And usually you'll find that it will. So that's the general approach to fear in Buddhist tradition. I mean, it's as simple as that, really. Just let yourself feel the fear. But one thing I should make clear, I suppose, before I wind up and open it up for questions, is perhaps we need to distinguish two kinds of fear. There's what we call rational fear and irrational fear. And most of what I'm talking about actually is irrational fear, but it doesn't discount rational fear either. But so let's say rational fear has an objective basis to it. So that, for example, if somebody was pointing a gun to my temple like that, I would have a very good reason to be afraid, because he might pull the trigger and that would be the end of my life. I'd be killed, I'd be dead. And so it would immediately induce the fear of death in me. But it would have an objective basis to it. If, on the other hand, I'm alone somewhere, perhaps on a solitary retreat, and I'm sleeping at night, and there's a noise downstairs, Sam, as happened to me many, many years ago in a cottage in Wales, in an isolated place, was a noise, and it sounded like a really loud noise. I've subsequently come to learn that mice can make a lot of noise. By the way, more noise than you might anticipate from such a tiny creature, but believe me, they can make a lot of noise. Even dung beetles can. I've had problems with dung beetles in Spain, rummaging around in your rubbish looking for food. Anyway, if you're on your own and you hear a noise, it's like your whole system goes on heightened alert. And it seems to amplify the sound, and it appears to be much much louder than perhaps it objectively is. But anyway, what happens in these situations sort of classically is that you start wondering what's caused the noise. Is there someone down there? The mad axe man. your mind can go into overdrive, your imagination can go into overdrive, and create a situation which has no relation to reality whatsoever. You know, it's just a mouse, an innocent little mouse making a bit of noise downstairs. So if you find yourself, you drive yourself into that sort of intensely fearful state, there's no objective basis to that. It's just the reactions taking place within your own mind. So that's irrational fear. And I think that's the kind of fear that very often we have to deal with, rather than objective fear. We're very in this society, which is so relatively secure and safe, we're not going to be facing many objective dangers or threats. That's not, of course, the case all over the world, but in this society, we're pretty free from that. So yes, we have to learn to face our own irrational fears. And sometimes a way to help with this is to deliberately do things which might normally make you afraid. This is going back some years ago. The Reader's Digest, of all publications, did a survey on what people feared most. This was many, many years ago. And what would invoke the greatest amount of fear in most people was the prospect of public speaking. The idea that you might have to stand up someday and give a speech or talk before an audience was too much for most of the people who responded to this the questionnaire that they sent out, presumably. So if you find that's, for example, something as innocent and simple as that invokes fear in you, well, why not volunteer sometime to give a talk, to give a speech? It's not that difficult, actually. I mean, most people are talking all the time anyway. In fact, most people, it's a problem to get them to shut up. So, given that that's the case for most of us, what is the problem when it comes to speaking to more than one person, or more than half a dozen? Maybe 60, or 500, or 5,000. It's the same situation, actually. But somehow people become very afraid of this sort of thing, or the idea of this thing. But there's nothing in that situation which is objectively threatening to you. It can't harm you. Unless, of course, you say something silly and you cause a riot, which I don't suppose many of you are likely to do, if any of you. So that's another thing that you can do. Going away on your own somewhere, going away to experience aloneness, is something else. That's almost guaranteed to bring up some sort of fear in you. If you're not used to it, just spend a whole weekend on your own. See what that does. How do you react to that? See if you can get through an entire weekend without distracting yourself from whatever it is you're feeling, without experiencing some kind of anxiety or fear. I think probably most people would find that they'd felt at least a little bit nervous. Well, that's a mild form of fear. And it's uncomfortable. We don't want to. We want to push it away usually. That's why we distract ourselves with television, etc., etc. Okay. Maybe that's enough as a preamble. I'd like to open it up to you now, see if you've got any questions about what I've said so far, and see if there's anything else that you'd like me to expand upon or say a bit more about. Yes?
Knowing when to fear, like fear of fast cars or whatever. It's so deep in us that it actually can be seen as a positive thing if it doesn't.
Well, I think that would be objective fear. You know, the idea of someone's pointing a gun at your temple. I mean, I remember once I was hitchhiking in Italy when I was young, and I was picked up by a couple of youths from Rome. And they decided to have some fun with me. I was in the back of the car, and there's no doors on my side, as it were. And they drove crazily for about an hour all over the place. And how we never had an accident escaped me. That was really dangerous, and I was scared. But I had good reason to be scared. But in the end, they just let me go. But it wasn't an experience I care to repeat, I can tell you. They were putting their own lives at risk as well. But yes, you have to distinguish between objective fear and irrational fear. And objective, if there's something which is an objective threat to you, you have to try and work out how you can get out of that situation. If I could have gotten out of that car, believe me, I would have done. But there was no way I could. It was not an option. So you just have to, all you can do then is accept the situation and just hope for the best. Or just accept it and not hope for anything. You had a question?
Yeah, I was just going to give an anecdote, actually. The retreat centre at Rivendell, which you'll know, obviously. People might know Rivendell. It's very close to a graveyard. Mm-hmm. Very close. And I found that I was there once, and everyone else was asleep. And I go out onto the lawn. I couldn't get off the lawn at that place on my own, in the dark, with the trees swaying and what have you. Then the next day, someone came with me, and we went all the way out to the graveyard, lay down next to a grave, and did a bed of bhavana. No fear at all.
Yeah.
And I've forever kind of contemplated why that was, where the fear was coming from, and why it disappeared in the presence of another person. Completely disappeared, because there could be no rationality. She could have protected me if the mad axeman was there.
No, right.
And it completely disappeared.
So did you then go back the following night on your own?
I then went back to somebody else, so everybody went, we split up. It was such a strange thing to be consumed with fear.
Yeah.
But then another person is present.
Right.
And it goes away.
Yeah, well, because it takes away the sense of your aloneness. I think that's something else that people fear, the fear of aloneness. Who will look after me when I'm old? Will I be left alone when I'm dying? All that sort of thing. But actually, we are alone in the world, whether we like it or not. You know, aloneness is an existential fact. We experience ourselves as being separate from other human beings. My mother, when she was dying, towards the end of her life, she said, "I want you there when I'm dying," which is problematic because I was travelling to India and back quite a lot. But I said, "Well, I will do my best to be there when you're dying, but you might die even when I'm upstairs in my bedroom, when I'm staying with her, and I wouldn't be with you." But anyway, I did actually have the good fortune to be with my mother when she died. But I can't honestly see that I was that much of a, my presence was much of a solace to her. She didn't really seem, when she was dying, she didn't really seem to be aware of me. Perhaps she was. She wasn't able to communicate in the last few hours, but she just seemed completely oblivious to my presence. So actually, even with someone near and dear to you at the point of your death, there's nothing really they can do for you apart from wish you well, extend goodwill towards you. But the fact is, you die alone. There's no way around it. But that's what most of us are most, well, what many people are afraid of, is just being left alone. Has anyone got that? I mean, does that affect anybody else here, or is it just, am I just saying this? Yes?
Sorry?
Well,
yeah, it's just that I really get that part of being alone, but it seems to confuse with being disconnected.
Sorry?
One thing can be being alone, and I just think that we are alone all the time.
Yeah.
But what about being connected or disconnected with others?
Well, I think if you have a sense of connection with others, it alleviates, it alleviates that sense of being alone. You don't feel it so much. In a way, it substitutes something else. But as soon as the other person's gone, perhaps you do feel alone. I mean, I think this is why people want to live. You want to live with other people. You want to have a partner or whatever. You don't want to be alone, because to be alone is, you find, unpleasant in some way. Many people do anyway. Not everybody, of course. At the back there.
Yeah, I was. I think quite a lot about this business of being alone, and it was my daughter was talking to her mother, and who said to her, he dislikes being alone, you know, and he will do just what he wants to do, which isn't really true, I don't think. But, I did at one point, just in my early 20s, I just left London and went and lived in a cottage. Sunset on my own. Because I wasn't tired on my own, I had to go to work and stuff like that.
Right.
And I found all the way through early adolescence, I wanted to do things, not particularly adventurous, but could I find anyone to do them with me? No. But I thought, I'm not going to be held back. I'm going to do what I want. If I have to do it, I'll do it on my own. And I found that perfectly acceptable. It didn't cause any fear. What I find now is, now that I'm older, in fact probably only the last couple of years, is I don't want to do things on my own anymore. I find that I'm not sure that I'm going to make the right judgments if there is only me to talk to about things, things to do. I'm without anyone to talk to, I am likely to miss something. Make a mistake.
Yeah.
So it's not always that I want to take somebody's advice, but they might just say something that helps me focus on what I need to think about.
Yeah.
And it's things like, I could go on those pages, but I've been trying to organise myself to go skiing in America, and I know this just sounds like having fun, but it's quite important to me that I do this, and it's been very difficult to do because I don't have anyone to go with. And whereas 20 or 30 years ago, I'd just gone and
sure.
I thought twice about it.
Yeah.
Now I find the idea of acting alone quite difficult.
Yeah. Well, I think the older you get, the more difficult it becomes. I think because you feel more vulnerable. That's partly it. But it occurs to me. It just occurred to me. There's something that I forgot to say, which I should have said earlier, which is that another very good way to deal with fear is to develop positive emotion. You know, we at this centre we teach two meditation practices, one of which is the development of universal goodwill or loving kindliness, and there's a whole sort of series of positive emotions which we try to encourage people to develop, and I think this also helps you when it comes to dealing with fear. Positive emotion. And if you are in a an emotionally positive state, fear is much less likely to arise. And if it does, you're but much better placed to be able to deal with it. Yes? I think that's I think that's been my experience. As some of you know, I did a long retreat, a 9-month solitary retreat, which came to an end about 18 months ago. And in the early part of my retreat, I experienced chronic anxiety. I wasn't surprised, but It reached a fever pitch at one point. And it was very difficult for me to deal with, very difficult to face. It took me quite a lot of effort, actually. But eventually, it seemed to resolve. When I look back at it, I think, well, it seemed quite clear to me that if I look back at the whole 9 months that I was in solitude like that, completely alone, I was doing quite a bit of meditation, of course, but my underlying mental state, I think, was very positive. It wasn't that clear to me at the time, but I think it was in retrospect. And I think because that was the case, I was able to deal more easily with the intensity of the fear which eventually arose. But I've spent 40 years before that doing the Metta-Bhavana practice and the mindfulness of breathing meditation practice. So, you know, if you like, that was my preparation. So, but I feel more than ever, actually, that positive emotion is a very, very good protection, if you like, against fear. But ultimately, it's not enough, because according to Buddhist analysis, fear can only arise in the presence of an ego sense. No ego sense, fear will not arise. Mind you, having no ego sense is equivalent to enlightenment. It's equivalent to being, well, have the same sort of experience as the Buddha. But that's what you're working towards. I think it's quite interesting that that the Buddha talks about his experience of fear in the context of just the few weeks before he gained enlightenment, before he finally gained enlightenment. It's almost as if fear is the ego's last stand. It's its last weapon to keep you in the samsara, for those of you who are Buddhists, to sort of prevent you from going beyond, as it were, this world. Yes?
Can you explain what ego sense is?
Well, it means an ego sense is a sense of yourself as a separate self from all other selves. There's me and there's the rest of the universe. That sense of division, if you like, the division between subject and object. And object includes the whole world, it includes other individual human beings. According to the Buddha's analysis, ultimately, that division it doesn't exist. It's just the way that we perceive what we consider to be reality. But in fact, reality is not like that. So anything which makes you feel separate from the rest of the world, from other people, from the universe at large, well, that is an ego sense. And we all of us have a very definite sense of who we are. This is me. And what holds that together, again, according to Buddhist analysis, is what we call ego clinging. The desire to sort of feel yourself as, well, what you believe yourself to be. But again, according to Buddhist analysis, ultimately, the idea of a self cannot hold. Because we are, you know, if you do any meditation, you do much meditation, you can see that your mental states are shifting and changing all the time. The tone of them, the quality of them, the content of them. There's nothing seemingly permanent or fixed within that at all. It's just a continuum.
How do we start to let go of that, what we think, who we think we are?
Well, I think first of all you have to find out who you are, which means you have to become more self-aware, become aware of what actually is going on in your own mind. What you actually think, if in fact you think at all, or is it just that you think you think? Do you just simply regurgitate the popular views of the society in which you live, or do you actually think for yourself? And then again, find out what you feel, what you really feel. Sometimes we're rather unwilling to do that, especially where strong emotions are concerned, whether of greed, hatred, fear, or anything else. We don't like to admit the darker sides of ourselves. But also, let's not just stay there. Let's acknowledge what's going on that is positive as well. If you feel goodwill, if you act kindly, acknowledge that to yourself. But learn to see what is well, who you are, what's driving you, what motivates you. And let whatever emerges into your awareness be there. And if it needs to be dealt with, deal with it. That's the first step. So you begin to know who you are. But then you have to, having established that individuality, if you like, you then have to slowly undermine it. Because it has no ultimate validity. The problem is, we think that this entity, as which we identify as me, is permanent and fixed. Whereas actually it isn't. It's shifting and changing all the time.
So I suppose by undermining who we think we are, one way maybe challenging, trying to conquer those whatever negative thoughts, those fears, like a day at a time, whatever comes up during the day, trying to sort of different.
Yeah, you try to work with your own mental states. I mean, this is what the Buddhist life is all about. This is what we try to encourage people to do. People who come to our classes here. This is why we teach meditation, because it gives you the tools whereby you can do that.
Could you say some more about fear of the faith, say the future? So many of us have sort of got fears of cancer or something like that.
Fear of the future.
So your mother seemed to be fearing the future, death.
Yeah.
But a lot of us, I guess, are fearful of future.
Yes. Yeah, sure. I mean, I know that very well. And I remember a few years back, maybe about 15 years ago, when I was in my early to mid 50s, it was something which troubled me a lot. I suppose I was going through a typical male midlife crisis. And having been single all my life, having lived mostly in men's communities involved in this movement, and having, you know, the prospect of nowhere to live for a while, I began to worry, who will look after me when I'm old? So I had that kind of fear, but it came to a climax for me, I think, when I was about 52 or 53. One night, the fear arose very strongly. At least, what it really was simply fear. And I had sufficient nous to realise that there was a vague thought in the back of my mind which was running to meet that fear. And the thought was, who will look after me when I'm old? And I sat up in bed and said, no, it's just fear. And so the idea did not attach itself to fear. And the fear, which is quite intense actually, subsided very quickly. So I think that of course, it's not quite natural when you get older to start worrying about the future or start fearing the future. But I think you just got to stop yourself from doing it. And it's not an easy thing, by the way. But I think that I've learned what to do with my mind, at least. You just don't let that idea attach itself to fear if fear arises. Fear will seek an object, just as desire will seek an object. Someone of the opposite sex who's very beautiful and attractive, or highly intelligent and handsome, take your pick. But if we allow whatever's driving us, whatever emotions are driving us, to latch onto an object, it then becomes very, very difficult to separate the fear from that object. That's why I took such decisive action that night in bed. You know, I mustn't let this happen. Otherwise, I'm not going to sleep all night. And fortunately, I got there just in time to stop it from happening. So I think you just got to stop yourself worrying about the future. There is no future anyway, from a certain point of view. That's a whole other story. Yes.
Following on from that and your response, if it is not about the object, where does it come from?
I don't know. I mean, it just seems to be a primordial, sort of almost animal sensation. Because animals get afraid too. It's not just a human emotion. You can see fear in animals.
But is it not always triggered by something?
It may be, or it may not be. It may be triggered by something objective, i.e. someone's putting a gun at my temple. Or it just may arise for no reason whatsoever. I think you just have to learn. It's a very difficult lesson to learn. It took me decades to learn it, but to just let it be. It's not permanent. It will pass. All experience comes and goes. There's nothing permanent about it. But it's very, very difficult to believe that when you're in the thick of it. If you're overcome by intense fear, it's like that's the universe. It's very, very difficult to see that it will actually finally eventually subside, calm down, and even disappear. And of course, it'll pop up again some other time, probably. but where does it come from? I don't think that's a question that can be answered. It's just part of human existence. It's part of what we call the samsara, conditioned existence.
So how do you distinguish fear from hatred or aversion?
Well, I mean, hatred...
You wouldn't let that be, would you? You wouldn't say, oh, I hate these people, so I'll...
Well, I've let my hatred sit. If it's there, I have to face it. It's not just trying to push it away. If I hate something or somebody, let it be, to start with, so I fully experience it. But then I work on it, because clearly you can't just act out of hatred. But hatred's in all of us. It's something we have to work with. It's something to be overcome. But the first step is acknowledging that it's there and allowing yourself to experience it. Then you have to work on it. That's the difficult bit. But since you mentioned hatred, of course there's very often a connection between fear and hatred. If you fear another person, you probably hate them. If you fear a whole group of other people, you'll probably hate them. This is what happens, of course, between nation states. We fear the enemy, or the enemy state, which is usually a neighbouring state. And so we go to war with each other, and we hate each other. And it arises out of fear of destruction. So fear and hatred do have quite a strong connection. Very often, not always, of course, but sometimes they do.
Can I bring something up?
Yes, sure.
The thing of where is this fear? There was supposed to be something within our brains at the back. It's called the thalamus or hypothalamus, something like that, which is susceptible to things like fear, anxiety, frustration, and that type of thing. When it's got some other stimulus that goes into it, like a hormone or something like that, or some external environmental factor.
Yeah.
You know? So that could be a thing to say where fear is.
Well, I mean...
If you know anything about it.
No, I don't. I'm not a neurologist. I've got a friend who is, but he could probably answer that question better than I could. But I suppose your question raises the issue of the interaction between mind and body, because the brain is part of the body. It's a bodily function, isn't it? And so there are perceptions coming into the brain all the time, and we place interpretations on those perceptions, and they may therefore stimulate the brain in a particular way. But I'm completely out of my depth here, because as I say, I'm not a neurologist. I can't answer a question like that.
Yes. What you said about the net being, just made me think about the judgment.
Yeah,
I know with fear and hatred, especially anger and hatred, what comes up for me is like straight judgment of I shouldn't be doing that.
Mm.
You know, I need to be, you know, especially being on some sort of spiritual path. Sort of, you know, it's always just like, oh, I should be enlightened.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, obviously I'm kind of learning just from experience that doesn't work. It causes more chaos in me. So, you know, I really understand that kind of let it be, and it's, you know, some sort of space. It's remembering to do or not to do something when it kind of comes up.
Yeah, that's right. It takes training, if you like. But I think that's where mindfulness comes in, because if you develop mindfulness, if you develop awareness, you find that you become more and more and more aware of what's going on in your mind, and you get to see more clearly the mechanisms in your mind, the particular way your mind is conditioned, if you like. And slowly you just gain more awareness and therefore more control over what's going on. I think that... Yes, I can understand many people would think or feel I shouldn't feel hatred. But the fact is, it's there. And if it's there, it needs to be dealt with. But if you feel, if you think or feel, as you've just described, that you think I shouldn't experience, I shouldn't be like this, or I shouldn't feel hatred, does that actually stop you with working on the hatred itself? Because that's the key thing. Does it?
Does it stop me from working on hatred? No, not really. No, it's because I'm aware of the judgment now, that voice.
Yeah.
That straight away, well, there's it going, you know.
So ignore the voice. You ignore the voice.
So yeah. So I do something counteractive. Either breathing, pausing, positive self-talk,
yeah.
Or you know, doing something. What helps is I share it. I will talk about it, so it's not it's just me.
Yeah. You talk about it to your friends.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that can be very, very helpful. It helps to make it objective, and well, it helps to objectify it, and therefore makes it easier to deal with. Yeah.
So do you see fear then as something that exists within us, and then different thoughts at different stages attach themselves to it, and it's sort of rising? Because, I don't know, I just sort of think about the idea of like spiralling anxiety. When you get nervous or anxious about one thing,
yeah,
you often get a lot of other things flooding in as well,
yeah.
And you find, you know, you can spiral. So is that what you're kind of saying?
I'm not quite sure, but I'll tell you what my experience has been. especially when I was on my long solitary retreat, I had a sense of anxiety building over a period of weeks, and I was trying to deal with it in various ways, but in the end it reached a climax, and I suppose in your terms it was spiraling. But what was the precise nature of your question again? Can you remind me? I think I've lost my...
So do you see fear as something that exists and can rise at points, and then different thoughts can attach themselves to it? You're describing that experience of the meeting.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in my case, in that context, what was happening was that I was getting all sorts of physical symptoms, which I was pretty damn sure was psychosomatic, but that was my brain at work. My emotions were telling me something else. And in the end, I managed to get underneath the anxiety by asking myself, why am I anxious? What's giving rise to this anxiety? And it seemed to me in the immediate answer to that question was because I'm attached to my physical body. That was the immediate answer. There was a deeper answer as well, but that was the first thing that I uncovered, and that was very helpful. Because then I asked further questions. Well, why am I attached to my physical body? I'm going to lose it anyway. I'm getting old. I can't live that much longer. I'm going to lose it sooner or later. Why not now? What a wonderful place to lose your body, you know, in this beautiful valley in Spain, in solitude. But I found ways of dealing with it. But yes, it does. It was latching on to, or at least it was highlighting, let's say, the attachment that I felt to my physical body. And that attachment was there because I identified with my physical body. I think many people do. When you think of who you are or what you are, you'll think of you, perhaps it's not conscious, but you say, oh, this is me. You know, it's the body. We feel ourselves to be the body, at least in part, a major part of that. Certainly that's been my experience. But these are all ideas in the end. They're just views. But if you can begin to cut underneath the surface and see that that's all they are, it undermines the fear. It helps it to slowly dissipate. But it's hard work. You've come to a dangerous place, by the way. If you haven't already sussed that. It's hard work coming here. The world, I suppose, the wider world sort of supports your ego sense in every possible way. If you come here long enough, we'll undermine that. At least you'll undermine it for yourself. And it's actually quite liberating when you begin to sort of find things loosening up in that kind of way. It's a very positive experience. Very happy experience, actually. However, we've run out of time. We're going to have to stop there because there's another talk starting in here in 5 minutes' time, I believe. If you want to stay for that, you're very welcome. If you want a break, now's the time to go.